From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, acting in the old Hollywood studio system, Celeste Holm was under contract at 20th Century Fox in the late 40s. Five of her films with the studio, including All About Eve and Gentleman's Agreement, will be shown at a retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art. Also, architect Andres Dewani returns to describe his alternative to today's suburbs, new communities modeled on the traditional small town. We get a historical perspective on the Two Live Crew controversy from rock historian Ed Ward, and Owen Gleiberman reviews Michael Caine's video on the craft of acting. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. More than 400 homes have burned and over 14,000 acres have been consumed by wildfires in Southern California. Kitty Feldy of radio station KLON reports.
Firefighters are anxiously keeping one eye on the winds as they try to contain this 3,500-acre brush fire. It was winds of up to 60 miles per hour yesterday afternoon that spread the fire up and down the foothills just north of Santa Barbara. So far today, the winds have died down, allowing air tankers to get in low enough to make water drops on the fire's hot spots. The brush in these areas are old and tinder dry due to California's four-year drought. The last time this area burnt was in 1955. Fire officials say the cause of the blaze is arson. No suspects are in custody at this time. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Santa Barbara.
At least 13 people were killed today when a car bomb exploded near a police station in the Colombian cocaine center of Medellin. A radio reporter and her three children were among those reported killed. At least 33 people were wounded. The bomb blast was the latest incident in a wave of violence attributed to Medellin's drug gangsters. Police say that more than 3,000 civilians and 140 police have been killed in the city this year. In northwestern Iran, a 9-year-old boy has been rescued alive nearly a week after the earthquake that killed between 40 and 50,000 people and caused more than $7 billion in damage, according to first estimates. Mike Theodulu reports from Nicosia.
As rescue workers wound down search operations to concentrate on the living, a Soviet team pulled 9-year-old Morteza from beneath the rubble of a flattened village. He'd been buried for 6 days and 18 hours with the bodies of his family. Though he received only minor injuries, he's still in a coma. Powerful aftershocks have continued to hamper relief work. One today caused landslides which cut off the devastated town of Rudbar for the second time in a week. But according to an Iranian expert, the fault that caused last Thursday's massive quake is gradually stabilizing. Meanwhile, there's been no let-up in supplies from overseas. Since the weekend, there's been over 200 flights from 26 countries, including the United States and Iraq. Such aid and hard cash will be needed for months to come. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
The Senate today resisted efforts to remove limits on semi-automatic assault weapons from its revived omnibus crime bill. Senators voted 50 to 48 in favor of keeping the restrictions on 9 kinds of semi-automatic guns. They then went on to add tougher mandatory sentences to the bill by a vote of 87 to 12. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 17 points to close at 2,878.7. Advances led declines by a margin of 9 to 5 in moderate trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was 136 million shares. This is NPR News. One of Donald Trump's major banks disclosed today that it will place as much as $157 million of its loans to the real estate tycoon on a non-performing basis. The decision was revealed in a regulatory filing by manufacturers Hanover. It's the first indication that Trump's financial troubles could have an impact on bank earnings. If Trump's other big lenders follow suit, they may be forced to increase their reserves for potential losses, thus cutting into earnings. Some 80 banks agreed last week to delay interest payments on $850 million of their $2 billion in outstanding loans to the Trump Organization. City officials in Birmingham, Alabama, say they're satisfied that the Shoal Creek Country Club will end its discriminatory policies against blacks. Lee Garnett of member station WUAL reports the city is now pledging full support for the PGA Championship that will be held at the club in August.
The controversy began when the country club's founder, Hall Thompson, was quoted as saying Shoal Creek had no black members because that's just not done in Birmingham. On Tuesday, the city withdrew its advertising from the tournament. Though claiming he'd been quoted out of context, Thompson has now issued what he calls a sincere apology. Eddie Blankenship is president of the predominantly black Birmingham City Council.
We're looking for more than anything else an apology. That apology came last night.
Birmingham civil rights leaders have canceled plans to demonstrate at the golf tournament, and the city's mayor, Richard Arrington, says Birmingham should get credit for addressing a problem that exists at private clubs across the country. For National Public Radio, I'm Lee Garnett reporting.
Analysts from the Central Intelligence Agency told a congressional panel today that China's economy is in a slump that could intensify social unrest. The CIA report said that China is experiencing its highest unemployment in a decade, along with other economic problems that have drawn the country's leaders away from market reforms. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Museum of Modern Art in New York is about to begin a retrospective of the films produced by 20th Century Fox. My guest, Celeste Holm, starred in five of the films they'll screen, including All About Eve. This cynical comedy, set in the New York theater world, starred Bette Davis as an aging, celebrated actress. Celeste Holm co-starred as her friend Karen Richards. This is how Karen Richards was introduced in the opening scene.
This is Karen Richards. She is the wife of a playwright, therefore of the theater by marriage. Nothing in her background or breeding should have brought her any closer to the stage than Row E, center. However, during her senior year at Radcliffe, Lloyd Richards lectured on the drama. The following year, Karen became Mrs. Lloyd Richards.
Unlike Karen Richards, Celeste Holm's early career got her a lot closer to the stage than Row E. Before she went to Hollywood, she starred as Ado Annie in the original Broadway production of Oklahoma. And she starred in Harold Arlen's musical, Bloomer Girl. For 20th Century Fox, she made The Snake Pit, Come to the Stable, Gentleman's Agreement, Letter to Three Wives, and All About Eve. At MGM, she made High Society. After the movie studio era, she guest starred on many TV shows and most recently appeared in the film Three Men and a Baby. We invited Celeste Holm to talk about her days under contract to 20th Century Fox. Daryl Zanuck was the head of the studio when Celeste Holm was signed. I asked her what he was like.
Well, he was short, and so he wanted to be tall, and he made very good pictures because of that. But a lot of good things have been done for the wrong reasons. But he asked me to come and see him, and he said, I met him at a party. He said, why haven't you come in to see me? I said, because you didn't ask. I said, I don't go where I'm not asked. So I came in to see him. Now, every day of the studio, they had asked me to come in at 6:30. This is making a picture called Three Little Girls in Blue. I was the one in red. And they said, come in at 6:30. And so I sat there from 6:30 to 5:30, 7:30, something like that, and never worked. I found out later that was called breaking the New York actress's spirit. Now, what a dumb thing to do. What they're buying is the New York actress's spirit. You get somebody that's limp or angry, what do you got? Nothing.
When you were signed, like, what's the first thing that happens? Do they send you to publicity right away so that,
yes,
that they could get a press release
they
out
on you?
They
sent me to publicity. I met an absolute idiot, and he asked me what I had done and where I came from and all that. So I told him. And I told him we had a farm in New Jersey and that my father had built a theater on it for us, a stage. So he wrote that Celeste Holmes' father had a theater built on their estate. My Lord, it was nothing like that at all. You know, they didn't understand at all. You tell them a fact, and they blew it up into whatever they thought was suitable. So they gave an impression which was totally false.
Were there facts from those old bios that followed you throughout your life?
Yeah, but not correct.
That's what I mean.
In other words, I went to school in Paris because my mother was a portrait painter and she was having an exhibit in Paris. And so she wanted to know if I wanted to go with her. Of course I wanted to go with her. And that's how I went to school in France. But it wasn't, you know, some elaborate, rich, self-conscious behavior, you know?
And did they have an image for you when you arrived that you were supposed to fit yourself into?
Nuh-uh. They better not. No. Because then, you see, I made one more musical called Carnival in Costa Rica. I'm glad they're not showing that. It had a wonderful score, but it was a very silly picture. And so from then on, I decided I would never be talked into a picture. So then Moss Hart asked me to be in Gentleman's Agreement, and I read the script and I said, yes, of course, immediately, any part. So that's how I got that.
Well, let me back up. When you were signed to 20th Century Fox, how was it decided which movies you'd be in? Would you have to audition for a film? Did they
just assign you
to a film?
No. They just said, this is your next picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd read it. You'd say, oh, this is so silly. And they'd say, yeah, well, yes, but this is what we want you to do. So the first picture, they talked me into it. They said, oh, it'll be wonderful. You'll be fine. And I was. I got very good notices. You know, Time said I was a wow and all that sort of thing. So then they were very anxious to put me in another thing. They put me in Carnival in Costa Rica, which was silly. Dumb. They never took us to Costa Rica. We hadn't any idea what Costa Rica was like. They did the whole thing in front of process shots with trees with coffee beans on them. So we had no sense of reality about any of it. Oh. But then came Gentleman's Agreement. I was rescued. And then, of course, I could never get back into a musical.
So was there an understanding that if you objected strenuously to a movie that you were assigned to, that you'd be punished?
Oh, sure. I went on suspension. I was on suspension a lot.
Oh, really? Like for what?
Oh, yes.
What would they put you on suspension for?
For turning down a picture.
And what would that mean when you were on suspension?
You didn't get paid.
Mm.
And when Gentleman's Agreement came along, they wouldn't let me have that picture unless I agreed to. See, I made the mistake of making it very clear I was dying to do it. So then they made me sign a term contract.
Let me ask you about one of the most celebrated movies that you've been in, and that's All About Eve.
Mm-hmm. I was no longer under contract when I did that.
And how did you do it without being under contract?
Mr. Mankiewicz insisted. Joe Mankiewicz wrote the script and produced it and directed it, and he wanted me.
How come you weren't under contract then?
Because the year before, they had a cutback, financial cutback, and my lawyer got a wire from Zanuck saying, would our dear Celeste, we have two more pictures in the can, they haven't been released yet, and we're very anxious for her to stay with us, of course, but would she object to not taking her $500 raise now, but take a $1,000 raise the next one, which would be a year later instead of 6 months, you see. No, it would be 6 months later. That's right. And so my lawyer called me and said, you want to get out? I said, oh, God, do I want to get out? So he wrote a letter saying, Miss Holm has fulfilled the terms of her contract. Why can't you? And Mr. Zanuck got very angry. And I was out.
But you wanted to be out?
Sure.
So you had
then he called all the other studios and said I was difficult.
Oh, further punishment.
And the next studio that hired me was his.
Oh, for All About Eve?
Yes.
Okay. Did you realize by looking at the script what a terrific movie
you
this was going to be?
Sure. Oh, I knew that would be a wonderful picture.
I'd like to play a short clip from a scene in All About Eve. This is the kind of culmination of the scene that starts with Bette Davis saying, fasten your seatbelt, it's going to be a bumpy night. Mm-hmm. So the party is coming to a close. Bette Davis is really drunk.
Very
and getting,
drunk.
Getting very bitter because she could tell Eve is really out to get her roles and out to get her man.
No, she doesn't know Eve is out to get her roles yet. She doesn't know. She wasn't understudy yet. She was just secretary. But she knew that she felt threatened in relation to her man.
So the party
at that point.
The party's wrapping up. People are kind of getting ready to go home. Bette Davis is really drunk, and here's the scene.
How about calling it a night?
And you pose as a playwright, a situation pregnant with possibilities, and all you can think of is everybody go to sleep.
It's a good thought.
It won't play. As a non-professional, I think it's an excellent idea. Excuse me. Undramatic, perhaps, but practical. Happy little housewife.
Cut it out.
This is my house, not a theater. In my house, you're a guest, not a director.
And stop being a star. And stop treating your guests as your supporting cast.
Now, let's not get into a big hassle.
It's about time we did. It's about time Margot realized that what's attractive on stage need not necessarily be attractive off.
All right. I'm going to bed.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have any conversations with Bette Davis like that off the set?
No. We had no conversations at all.
You weren't even on speaking terms?
I had nothing to say to her.
Why not? What was she like to work with?
Excellent. She was fine to work with. But there was no small talk.
You mean she allowed no small talk?
Well, she had nothing to say to anybody, and so consequently nobody had anything to say to her.
Let me quote something that she said in... this is in the 1970s when she got an AFI, an American Film Institute Lifetime Achievement Award. And at the
I was there.
Okay, at the party after the banquet, she said, Joseph Mankiewicz did give me a second career, but he was slightly in error describing the wonderful cast of Eve. They were wonderful, but there was one bitch, Celeste Holm.
Did she really?
Well,
oh, that's funny. Well, she was the only bitch I've ever worked with.
Why do you think she said that about you?
Because I had no patience with her. First day I walked onto the set, I said, good morning. And she said, oh, shit, good manners. So I thought, well, this is a waste of time. So I had nothing to say to her. And then I'm delighted that she said that. Oh, good. So at one point, she suddenly lost her temper. And her mother was visiting the set. And she had never talked this way before. She did this in front of her mother. She used four-letter words in combination I've never even heard a sailor use. And I said, I'm going back to my trailer, and when Miss Davis gets herself together, call me. And then when we were playing in 21, we were all sitting there together. And... So I came back from having talked to Eve in the ladies' room.
Mm-hmm.
And Anne and I were very good friends. I mean, I loved everybody in the cast, except Betty, because she wouldn't let you love her. So we were all sitting there, and I said, did you know that the man who made the wonderful glass teapot, Pyrex, when he found out they were using it to make martinis, he stopped making them. And Betty drank more than she should, I thought. And so she looked at me and she said, I don't know how I've lived this long without knowing that. So I don't know who was the bitch.
Did this kind of tension between you two get translated into your acting? Into the scenes that you played together?
I don't think it did. I thought we were both very good together. Everybody said... You must be really very good friends. I said, no, not really.
Celeste Holm is my guest. And we're talking about some of the movies that she made.
By the way, I have never had any difficulty with any other actress in any other show, ever.
Well, Marilyn Monroe had one of her first roles in All About Eve. And
I got to be a very good friend of hers.
What were your first impressions of her when she came onto the set?
I thought she was a sweet, dumb little girl.
Was that your impression after you'd worked with her more?
Yes, because she wasn't terribly good in that. She got awfully good after she worked at the Actors Studio and so forth. I thought she was absolutely marvelous in Bus Stop. Marvelous.
Mm-hmm. Now, you worked with Joseph Mankiewicz. You know, he wrote, directed All About Eve. You'd worked in other of his films as well.
Letter to Three Wives.
Yeah. What kind of director?
Wonderful man.
Tell me what his directing was like, especially when he was directing his own lines, and his writing was so good. There's so much clever dialogue.
Very bright, yes. Well, it was more than dialogue. It was that the characters of the people were interesting.
Mm-hmm.
They were individuals, and that's what good writing is about, and nobody seems to know that now. Most writing is just somehow get it onto paper, and if all the lights are left on, well, let's print it. It's very sad. It's not good enough.
So what was his way of directing you? Did he have...
No, he didn't have any particularly good... We just saw to it that we didn't bump into each other or the furniture. Most of us are pretty good actors, you know, so he left us pretty much alone.
Uh-huh. I'll tell you what, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your movies and about your stage career. And my guest is actress Celeste Holm, and she was under contract to 20th Century Fox for a few years, and the Museum of Modern Art in New York is doing a retrospective of the movies of 20th Century Fox beginning in July. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Celeste Holm is my guest, and her movies include All About Eve, Gentleman's Agreement, The Snake Pit, and High Society. You were directed by Ilya Kazan in Gentleman's Agreement.
Yes, indeed.
What was he like as a director?
He's a very interesting director. He's a secretive director. For instance, if he has a piece of direction for you, he'll whisper it in your ear so the other actors don't hear what it is. Then he whispers in their ears. And then you do the scene again, and you try to figure out what he said to them by what they do. And they try to figure out what he said to you. It's very interesting and very truthful because all good actors have secrets. All interesting people have secrets, which is why you want to get to know them better.
What's one of the secrets he whispered in your ear?
You cannot stand that girl. I want to see it very quickly and then cover it.
And why wouldn't he have wanted the actress that you were playing opposite again to know that? Why not?
Well, because your relationship to somebody is your own relationship. He did not want it to be an inimical one. He did not want a confrontational thing at all. He just wanted that subtle business where one woman looks at another and doesn't much like her, you know?
Can you remember any of the other advice he gave you?
No. I just remember that one in particular. Because, you see, usually directors direct out in the open so that everybody hears everything.
Mm-hmm.
But this, I think, is far more interesting. And it means we keep our secrets. So often when a movie is being directed or a play, a director will say something to an actor. An actor will go into a long screed about why he doesn't want to do that and tells much more about himself than you want to hear.
You know, we had been talking before about how you ended up getting out of your contract with 20th Century Fox. Why did you want to get out of it?
Because I wasn't, you see, having had quite a bit of experience before I came to pictures, I knew what I could do best. And I thought it was better that I do things that I do better than to do things that in which I was not particularly, I didn't feel particularly distinguished. I mean, that's what a star is. A star has a quality which you protect. Well, Zanna didn't know what the hell that was. He'd never even seen me. He got a clue out of Gentleman's Agreement, but how many scripts do you get like Moss Hart's writing? So then, of course, it came out again with Mr. Mankiewicz. So it was not a, it was a story studio. Fox was a story studio. They had a lot of interesting pictures. Not as much character studio. In other words, they were not as interested in the character of the people as they were in the stories.
What was the reputation of the different studios among actors?
Well, I found out later. I probably would have done a great deal better at Metro. I always loved working at Metro. High Society we did at Metro. Mm-hmm. Tender Trap I did at Metro.
Mm-hmm.
And they were both delicious pictures, delightful. And a much more human studio. I don't think Zanuck liked actors. I know he didn't like women. He liked girls. They would say, yes, whatever you say. But if you say, wait a minute, I'm not sure that's going to work. Well, he didn't want to hear that.
So in what way was MGM more human? You said you really liked them.
Well, it was just more fun.
Uh-huh.
They seemed to realize that humor and... I've always had a sense of responsibility about keeping a set alive and happy because that's what photographs. You know, we're the only industry outside of musicians whose work is referred to as playing. And it has to be playing. We have to really play together. And that's what the audience responds to. If it's work, it's not, you don't want to watch. And that kind of pleasure, that kind of balloon, that kind of bubble in the air, it's what makes all good comedy. And it's what the audience really enjoys.
Since we brought up High Society, let me ask you about making that movie. And as you pointed out, it's an MGM movie made in 1956. Now, you played opposite Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby in this. What was it like to work with Sinatra? You also worked with him in The Tender Trap.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always gotten along well with children. And Frank's charm is that he's like a child. He wants everything his way, and he wants it now. And he sings beautifully. And as long as all of those things are functioning, well, he's just a pleasure.
And if they're not?
Hmm?
And if they're not functioning?
Well, then he sometimes walks off the set.
Did that happen a lot during High Society?
No. No. Happened once in Tender Trap.
What did he walk out over?
Astonished us all. Just astonished us. Couldn't believe it. You know, just suddenly saying, well, I don't want to shoot any more today. Of course, he was also delicious in it. He was absolutely wonderful in it.
Were you sorry when the film studios broke up?
Yes, I was very dismayed and disheartened by that because, you see, the most important thing about freedom is responsibility. If you don't have a sense of responsibility about what you do, it's not very good as a rule. And the studios had all those theaters to fill, so they had a sense of responsibility to those theaters. And the minute those theaters were gone, they didn't have that. And pictures were not as good after that. Then they no longer had all those people under talent, under contract, which they had to protect.
How did it change?
The industry was really very changed by that.
How did it change your career when the studio system ended?
I went right to New York and did a play. It didn't matter to me.
How often do you go to the movies now?
Oh, at least once a week.
And
of course, during Oscar time, when I have to vote, I have to... Oh, God, sometimes I see 6 movies a week to catch up. But that's why I see so many during the year, so I don't have to do it all at one in one clump.
And what are your impressions of how movies have changed?
Oh, I think they've improved in some ways, and I think the writing has not. I think the technical aspects have improved, but I think the concepts are dumb for the most part.
Are you going to the 20th Century Fox retrospective at the Museum of Modern Art?
Absolutely, sure, when I get back. And fortunately, they have showing each picture at least twice, so I hope to be able to see the ones that I want to see. Although there's some in there, I don't know why they bothered. Uh-huh.
Celeste Holm, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
The Museum of Modern Art in New York presents its retrospective of the classic years of the 20th Century Fox Studio from July 1st to September 11th. Celeste Holm is featured in 5 of the films, including All About Eve and Gentleman's Agreement. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, writer Andrei Codrescu. You may know him from his commentaries on NPR. We'll talk about growing up in Romania, emigrating during the Ceausescu regime, and learning a new language and a new culture in America. I hope you can join us. Here's Celeste Holm and Frank Sinatra in High Society.
Would I trade places with Miss Tracy Lord for all her wealth and beauty? Just ask me.
All right, I will. Can you trade places with Miss Tracy Lord for all of her wealth and her beauty?
Well, you know, I can't help thinking about it.
Who wants to be a millionaire?
I don't.
Have flashy flunkies everywhere?
I don't.
Who wants the bother of a country estate?
A country estate is something I'd hate.
Who wants to wallow in champagne?
I don't.
Who wants a supersonic plane? Who wants a private landing field too?
Wait, I don't.
And I don't, cause all I want is you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Architect Andres Duwani says today's suburbs were designed for cars, not people. But they've become so congested, even the cars are having a rough time. Coming up, Duwani talks about his alternative, new communities based on the small town, where a lot of what you need is within walking distance. Also, rock historian Ed Ward looks back at some of the early records that in their day were as controversial as Two Live Crew is today. And critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Michael Caine's new video on the craft of acting. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has decided to keep a ban on semi-automatic assault weapons that was passed earlier this month. The gun control measure was attached to an omnibus crime bill. NPR's Cokie Roberts has more.
Republican Senator Phil Graham of Texas tried to remove the assault weapons ban from the crime bill, and he brought in Vice President Dan Quayle to vote with him in case there was a tie. But the Senate voted 50-48 to keep the gun control measure in place. After initially approving the prohibition on the semi-automatic weapons, senators found themselves the targets of a major lobbying campaign by the National Rifle Association. And for a while, it appeared that the gun ban would kill the crime bill it was attached to. But Senate leaders revived the bill, and today, the Senate staved off the effort to do in the assault ban. Most of the work on the crime bill is expected to be over by tomorrow, so the measure can be voted on after the July 4th recess. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Fires that officials believe were caused by arsonists have burned more than 300 homes in Southern California as flames pushed on by wind covered over 14,000 acres. Over 40 firefighters have been injured as flames destroyed rows of homes and then skipped over others. From Santa Barbara to San Diego, thousands of people were forced out of their homes by the smoke and fire. The situation was made worse by 4 years of drought and high temperatures and water reserves at their lowest point in years. The fire also destroyed businesses and a school for handicapped adults. The West German government is being criticized for failing to solve a pollution problem on U.S. military bases in West Germany. Deidre Berger filed this report.
A state parliament delegate today called the extent of contamination at U.S. military bases in West Germany shocking. Gernot Rotter said about 300 sites are badly contaminated with toxic waste, such as fuels, solvents, heavy metals, and insecticides. About 25 of the sites will require long-term cleanup operations. Rotter represents the Environmental Green Party in the state of Rhineland-Palatinate. Rotter said he was concerned the Bonn government has done nothing to deal with the problem. Many of the more serious contamination problems involve toxic waste that have leaked into the groundwater supply and will cost tens of millions of dollars to clean up. Officials at the Bonn Foreign Ministry today claim the problem must be worked out at the local level between state governments and U.S. military authorities. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 16.5 points to close at 2,878.71, on volume of some 136 million shares. Trading was moderate as advancing issues led declines 9-5. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. All the controversy over the rap group Two Live Crew's explicit lyrics has got rock and roll historian Ed Ward thinking. Rap music may be a relatively new development in pop music, but the controversy over lyrics goes back to the early days of rock and roll.
With Me Annie by Hank Ballard and the Midnighters was a historic record. It was one of the very first songs by a black artist that sold in quantity to white teenagers in the 1950s, and it started the process of closing a yawning racial gap. But we shouldn't lose sight of why those teenagers bought it. It wasn't because Hank and the Boys sang in tight jazzy harmony. It wasn't because of the bluesy inflection in Ballard's voice. Nor was it the rockin' beat. They bought it because it was dirty. That line about, "Give me all my meat," was pretty racy in 1954, and kids would gather around the turntable and bug their eyes. "I can't believe he really said that," they'd say. Naturally, what got me thinking about the Annie records, which also included Annie Had a Baby and Sexy Ways, was the recent furor around Two Live Crew, particularly the chilling photograph of the black record salesman being handcuffed as he was arrested for selling it. A local newspaper reporter called me and asked, "But hasn't rock and roll always pushed the limits sexually?" That's one way to look at it, I guess. But ever since the day in the 1920s, when a Midwestern bishop told his flock that jazz was leading the youth of America down the primrose path to hell, those were his very words, there's been conflict between what the older generation perceives and what teenagers are doing. And when it turned out that what teenagers were doing was crossing racial lines, there was going to be trouble no matter what. Nor was it just a question of racial lines.
And now here is Elvis Presley.
The myth has always had it that Elvis appeared on Ed Sullivan's TV show, shot from the waist up. But in fact, by the time he reached Sullivan, he'd already been on the Dorsey Brothers show and Sullivan's hated rival, Steve Allen's show. The waist-up treatment only happened once on Sullivan. That may have been censorship, but as it turned out, Elvis was as good a censor as could have been hoped for. When he recorded Big Joe Turner's immortal Shake, Rattle, and Roll, he left out the verse that said, "You wear those dresses, sun comes shining through, I just can't believe all of that belongs to you." And when he recorded Smiley Lewis's One Night, he changed it from "One night of sin is what I'm now paying for" to "One night with you is what I'm now praying for." No, if you go back to the original editorials and letters to the editor, you'll see what people really didn't like about Elvis was that he was poor white trash. All of the rockabillys were, and of course very few of the great black entertainers of the period came from the upper classes. It was okay for a Jewish boy from a middle-class background like Benny Goodman to be insolent, but it was clear that a lot of these new performers, be they Elvis, James Brown, Little Richard, or Jerry Lee Lewis, didn't know their place. There's another consideration we should keep in mind when the Two Live Crew issue comes up, too. Party records. If you're old enough to remember the 50s, you know what I'm talking about. Records of dirty comedy routines and songs, sexually explicit, by performers like Rusty Warren, Red Fox, and the folks who remind me most of Two Live Crew, Doug Clark and the Hot Nuts. Doug Clark made a fortune touring white fraternities, in which I'm willing to bet more than one of today's DAs and other anti-obscenity crusaders grooved to his crude rewrites of rhythm and blues classics. Unfortunately for the record companies who recorded these party acts, though, nobody ever set out to get them. As Two Live Crew has found out, you can sell a lot of records that way. The anti-obscenity crusaders have, as always, targeted the music enjoyed by the underclasses of America's teenagers, rap and heavy metal. The prosecution, though, has struck another all-important rock and roll lifeline, independence. Two Live Crew does not record for a major label, and the guy whose photograph I saw was not being handcuffed in a chain record store, but in a mom-and-pop store he owned. Both independent labels and independent retailers have always been in the forefront of rock and roll. They've been the ones to take chances on unknown groups, recording them and selling them to their original core of fans who give them visibility in the marketplace that can lead to mass acceptance. Independent labels and independent retailers just don't have the financial clout to sustain protracted litigation, and the chilling effect of that has me as scared as the First Amendment threat does. But to go back to the reporter's question, sure, rock and roll has always pushed the limits. It's teenagers' music, so it's bound to be offensive and obnoxious to elders. Big deal. What's scary is the extent to which the federal government has gotten involved. Once they restricted themselves to doing things like drafting Elvis. Now, with record labeling, sending record clerks to jail and confiscating their personal property, and putting party records on trial, it's a whole new ballgame. I think we should ask ourselves if we really want to play.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle.
You gotta fight for your right to party! You gotta fight for your right to party!
This is Fresh Air. One out of 10 Americans lives in a planned unit development, but some architects think planned suburban communities have failed. Yesterday, architect Andres Duany gave us a few reasons why. He says they were built for cars, not people. You need a car to get a quart of milk or to get your child to school. And even if you wanted to walk, there's often no sidewalk to walk on. Duany and his partner, Elizabeth Platter-Zeeberg, build new communities modeled on the small town. In the Atlantic magazine, they were described as the masters and the most prolific practitioners of this new, old form of design. And their Florida community, Seaside, was described as the most celebrated new town of the 80s. I asked Duany how he designs a town so that what you need is within walking distance.
The suburbs, basically, should be designed as neighborhoods. And each neighborhood should have a center, possibly with a square, almost certainly with a corner store and a daycare center. And that center should be within 5 minutes walking distance of the majority of the residents. The reason I say 5 minutes is that almost everyone will walk 5 minutes rather than drive. Now that becomes doubly important when you think of potentially public transit in the future. If we are to have public transit, whether it's streetcars or buses, people will use it only if they can walk to it. People do not get in their cars and then park and then take the bus or the streetcar. You need to capture the public transit population within walking distance. So the basic increment of planning that we use in our communities is the 5 minute walking distance. That is the size.
What do you think makes for a good suburban sidewalk?
It is important. There are several things that are important. One is that the sidewalk should be buffered by a line of parked cars. People should park on the street because that line of parked cars provides a buffer to the moving cars. And it is comfortable to be in a sidewalk only when you're buffered. Another very important thing we cannot forget is that human beings are human beings and they like to be amused. And that the buildings which align the street should have windows and doors and porches and not parking garages or garage doors. People do not like walking past parking lots or parked cars. And it is important that whenever codes are written, that there be some provision for the car being parked somewhere away from the sidewalk so that people can experience the buildings that they walk by. One other thing, of course, is the provision of trees, I don't think is an option. Street trees are a social necessity.
So you like parallel parking alongside the sidewalk, but you don't like a parking lot where all the parked cars are
Yes.
adjoining the sidewalk.
Right, right. There's a difference between parking on streets. The best streets in the world have parking. The best squares in the world have parking. Parking in single layer is just fine. The problem comes when we have these enormous parking lots. Parking lots are always negative. They feel bad when cars are there, and they feel bad when cars are gone.
So where would you put the parking lots?
I would put them in the backs of the buildings so that going from the street into the block would be the lanes on which the cars travel. There would be the parked cars. There would be the trees. Then there would be the sidewalks. And then there would be the buildings. And then behind the buildings would be the parking lots.
So as you've said, in communities that you're designing, you have shops and town centers within a five-minute walking distance.
Yes.
What comprises a good town center in your design?
Well, there are minimum town centers that I can describe very easily. There needs to be some kind of space or place. It can be a special intersection or it can be a town square. And that town square should be a source of civic pride. In other words, it shouldn't be a playground or a high school basketball court. There's a place for that elsewhere. But the town center should be a place of civic of civic consequence. It should be maintained, in other words. And then the corner store is, I think, terribly important because it, for example, it absorbs many of the car trips, especially the mindless car trips that we would otherwise make. You can walk and buy milk or orange juice or cat food or whatever instead of having to drive for everything that you forget. And that corner store isn't just a utilitarian place where you shop. It's also the social center. You go there and you might meet other people. It is particularly good if it's associated with a post office and with a bank, one of these automatic bank tellers, because that brings a lot of people to that area, and again, the people meet each other. And finally, that corner store makes a wonderful place to wait for the bus or the streetcar, because you can wait in shelter, you can get a cup of coffee and a newspaper, and wait in dignity for the public transit. We underestimate how awful it is to wait for a bus in one of those awful benches which are provided. It's very undignified. It's important not only to provide safe, clean, and decent public transit, it is important that the place where one waits is also a place of dignity, and that cannot be underestimated.
So you'd have the equivalent of a corner store within walking distance. What about the big supermarkets and the Kmarts?
Oh, well, the supermarket continues to be necessary because there are certain uses that we will not walk to, the ones that involve a lot of carrying. We're accustomed to doing big shopping trips, so once a week or so, you can go to the supermarket and pick up 12 bags. Also, the dry cleaning, that's heavy stuff to be walking around with, so you drive to that. But there are other uses. For example, eating someplace, that doesn't require the carrying of anything. You can easily walk to a restaurant. In fact, it's a pleasure to walk before and after you eat. You can drop a kid off at the daycare center without having to drive. And there's a multiplicity of uses which can be handled by walking. But we're very realistic, and we know that certain American habits, such as the shopping trip, the large weekly shopping trip, will continue to take place, and we do provide enough parking for those. In fact, we provide enough parking. These traditional towns, the new ones that we're designing, are walkable, but they also have all the necessary parking. We're not eliminating that.
Now, I think in the towns that you're designing, you have apartment space mm-hmm. over all the stores. Why do you like to have apartments over the shops?
Several reasons. One is that we like places to be alive during the day and during the night. If you have these neighborhoods in which you only... which are only workplaces, and they're abandoned at night, they're not even safe. So having both housing and housing and shops and office buildings together gives a nighttime and daytime use to a place. Also, the parking can be shared. You know, some of the parking is used during the day, and then the parking lot can be used at night for the people who live above the stores or near the stores. It doesn't have to be above. As opposed to the condition we have now, in which we have to make two huge parking lots, some of them for use during the day and some of them for the night. But above all, we found that senior citizens very much enjoy living at the town center above the store, because that's where the action is, there's lots to look at, and they can fulfill their daily needs by very short walking trips.
Is this also a way to get more inexpensive housing into the community? I imagine the apartments over stores would be less expensive than whole units.
Sure, you're absolutely right. The apartment above the store is not the American dream, and therefore it tends to be delivered affordably, and it tends to remain affordable. The problem with other types of affordable housing is that when you do a very good job with it, it becomes expensive. But apartments above the store tend to remain relatively affordable.
When you're designing one of your communities, do you have to fight zoning ordinances as you build?
We often do. The zoning ordinances, which are presumed to be neutral, in fact, we find are not neutral at all. And what they have in mind is the suburban sprawl, which we see all around us. The zoning ordinances, the way they're written, actually are premised on high traffic use, on high traffic, high parking, and the segregation of uses. And if you were to come in and say, well, I have designed here this little town, which is just like that little town that you love, in the county, say, and you put forth a design, they'll say, well, this needs 10, 15, 20, 25 variances to build something like that. What we found is that in the end, the codes that are in place promote suburban sprawl, and they make it virtually impossible for a developer to easily build a traditional town.
So what do you do?
Well, we find developers that are willing to put up with the inconvenience of getting the variances. We sometimes write new ordinances. Often we find that when we point this out to the citizenry or to the political leaders, they say, well, we didn't know this was the case. Can you write an ordinance for us that will make traditional towns possible? And we do that. But in the end, I think that what we do is just hold out until we get it right. And it's really not as difficult as it seems. In most places, people are so sick and tired of the traffic and the congestion and the pollution and the stress that they know what we're talking about, and they lift their restrictions fairly quickly. We find that we're very received very kindly by most places when we propose a traditional town.
Have you ever lived in the kind of traditional town that you're trying to do a contemporary version of?
Well, we have lived. I grew up in Barcelona in Spain, which is larger than a town, but it is a traditional city. My partner, Elizabeth, grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania. And whenever we have the chance, for vacations, for example, we go to traditional towns and live the life of which we describe. So we know what it's like, and it's not available to us currently in Miami. Otherwise, you can be certain that we would immediately move to whatever is available, which feels and functions like a traditional town.
Architect Andres Duwani, he and his partner Elizabeth Platter Zeeberg have an architectural firm based in Miami. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Fires in California, the biggest one set by an arsonist in Santa Barbara. Hundreds of homes there destroyed by mountains of fire, it's reported. Also, the arrest videotape is shown at the trial of Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry. ANC leader Nelson Mandela travels to Miami. We'll have a report. Japan and the U.S. have reached an agreement on some very significant trade issues. More about the Hubble Space Telescope, explanations about why the telescope's mirror was not fabricated properly, and letters from listeners this evening, complaints about satire, and about the lyrics to the Frank Sinatra song, Fly Me to the Moon.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The versatile actor Michael Caine shares some insights about his art in a new video called Acting in Film. Film critic Owen Gleiberman has a review.
The career of Michael Caine is testimony to how lazy the rest of the movie industry has become. Here's an enthusiastic working actor who makes 3 or 4 pictures a year. Nothing too outrageous about that. Yet in an era when your typical Hollywood megastar spends more time appearing at Save the Rainforest benefits than he does in front of the camera, Caine's eagerness to get out there and make films seems almost radical. It's often made him the butt of jokes. More than once, I've heard Caine referred to as the guy who did Jaws 4 to get a free Caribbean vacation. The truth, though, is that watching Michael Caine act has become one of the chief pleasures of modern movies. And in the new video, Acting in Film, his passion is on full, exhilarating display. This hour-long tape consists of nothing more than Caine holding an informal masterclass with 5 acting students. He lets them in on some of his secrets and guides them through scenes from his films, including Alfie, Death Trap, and Educating Rita. You don't have to be an aspiring actor to be mesmerized by Caine's performance. His lesson is a simple one. It's that acting in films is far more intimate than anyone imagines. Whereas on stage you have to project to an audience, in movies the camera can turn the slightest change of expression into riveting drama.
The camera is like a belt or a net behind you, and someone saying, or someone standing behind you and saying, look, you can relax, it's okay, you don't have to push it, like, say, in the theater. You don't have to push it. Just relax and let it come out. If you do it right for them, for this camera, it will catch you every time you fall back. It's watching you. It's your friend. It loves you. And it is listening and watching everything you do. You don't have to do it big. You don't have to shout and scream. And nobody exists except us six.
Kane's message is derived from the commandments of classic method acting. In essence, he's saying, don't act. Be yourself. Get in touch with a character by revealing the mysteries of your own personality. Yet Kane's method couldn't be more different from that of the infamous acting teachers who turned their classes into glorified psychodrama. On screen, he's just about the least showy performer alive. And as this tape makes clear, he believes in the actor as microsurgeon. He understands that an entire scene can live or die depending on which eye you're looking out of.
Now, you see actors, and they're acting, and they change, and it's an infinitesimal thing in the eyes, as they change eyes as they're talking. Can you see my eyes changing here?
Yes.
Just I'm changing eyes.
Yeah.
And I'm blinking. Now, that is two of the worst things to do. First of all, you never change eyes, and what you do is you pick an eye. And if I keep blinking, it weakens me. But if I'm talking to you, and I don't blink, and I just keep going, and I don't blink, and I keep on going, and I don't blink, you start to listen to what I'm saying.
Kane knows how to get the best out of his students. He's a wonderful teacher, at once sly and compassionate. Late in the tape, he shows a young actor how to play a drunk scene from Educating Rita. His performance is so subtle that simply by sinking into his chair an extra millimeter, he brings the character new dimensions of pathos. Acting in film is finally a study in the mysteries of modern filmmaking. By the end, it's clear that no one knows more about those mysteries than Michael Caine.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, Dan Lachlan, Joyce Lieberman, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, poet, essayist, and NPR commentator Andrei Codrescu tells us what it was like to leave his native Romania and come to America. Also, we meet Chrissy Hynde, the leader of the rock group The Pretenders. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.